from, well, I would say from the standpoint of the legislature, he is, no question about it. I mean, it's at least increased the urban representation in the House of Representatives. And this has been one of the biggest improvements, I would say, in professionalism in the state government has been in the House of Representatives, which formerly was a, you know, overwhelmingly rural, and no longer that, and there's a real strong nucleus of maybe 40 or 45 younger, aggressive, intelligent legislators in the House of Representatives that I think are really providing some potentially good leadership for the state, and maybe from that group will come, you know, elected, a lot of other elected officials. However, we haven't seen too much success in that yet. Yeah, reapportionment has definitely helped. I think one of the things is the state as an economic, the factor of money, the availability of revenues now is this amount of money that the state is dealing with is just increased tremendously in the last 10 years. I mean, no comparison with what the budget was. So, they have been more or less forced into adopting some more practical business-like methods and, for example, going to an annual session of the legislature, a limited session of the legislature, and that we formerly had unlimited biennial sessions, you see, and it was a very, very loose way of appropriating money, you know, and estimating revenues and so on, required a lot of special sessions and everything, and then we've so far been able to avoid special sessions pretty much, so, but...
Who makes the revenue estimate?
Well, there's a State Budget and Accounting Commission, which is made up of mostly of legislators. They do the estimating for
it. But is there any individual that does it for them?
No.
Nobody like the State Treasurer or anything?
No, the Director of the Budget Commission, he has no real great power in there. It's Budget Commission speaking whenever they estimate the revenue. That's the governor has to pretty well. He doesn't present an independent budget in Mississippi. I mean, the law says that he's supposed to, but he adopts the Budget Commission budget, which is made up, as I said, mostly legislators, and it's been highly traditionally conservative. And one of the odd things right now is that there's been a reversal in the trend of revenues. The state began building up tremendous surpluses here about 4 years ago as a result of increased taxes and going to the withholding income tax. And suddenly, the surplus has just burgeoned here. Then they had money available in the treasury like they never had before. And also catching the rise in the state economy. I mean, suddenly the state was dealing with a budget of a quarter of $1 million, and suddenly the thing's gone way over $500,000 a year. I mean, this is a general fund budget, you see. And also building up some tremendous surpluses. Well, the recent, the energy crisis and the national economy in being the state it is, there's been a change in the trend in the suddenly, now it appears that the state is not going to collect the kind of revenue that the Budget Commission was estimating. So they're trying to pull back, and the surprising thing is the legislature doesn't want to pull back. They want to still appropriate like there's going to be a bottomless pit there. And so now the Budget Commission is trying to put the brakes on, and they can't seem to have much success with the legislature. But I would say, dealing with a great deal more money and revenue than that the state is now possible to do things that they never could do before. I mean, and so they're entering into into many programs that that they never did participate in before. And the influence of federal funds too in the state has been tremendous. I think that's changed a lot of the attitudes of politicians too. I mean, they love to spend that federal money here, and they don't turn it down.
Has most of this change occurred in the last 10 years in terms of politics?
I think really since Ross Barnett. Ross Barnett possibly killed off a whole generation of progressives in this state. I mean, because once he was elected, it sort of changed plans, I would say, of a lot of people in the state who would have gone into politics. But it was discouraging that to any progressive that Barnett could be elected, and not only that, become almost made a hero, during all this. And only until finally the course taken by Barnett was really repudiated when he, ran for governor again in 67 and ran a very poor fifth in a seven-man race.
Was that the real turning point then, 67?
I think the politics of 67, although I don't think that, I mean, the state did not elect someone who turned the state around. I mean, I think they were still in the process of change. But repudiating Barnett was one thing, and I mean, which I think finally gave brought on a new crop of politicians who have some hopes, that you can be a moderate and a progressive publicly and maybe succeed in Mississippi politics. The one person that stands out through all this period is the symbol of the moderate politician, William Winter, who is still, the lieutenant governor now, but who did run for governor in 67 and did not win, you see. Although, he made a very, very good race, and he was in the runoff and led the ticket in the first primary, but got beat. And I think that was probably the last race in this state, the last gubernatorial campaign that would really be decided on the politics of race. I mean, that was the subtle undercurrent, that really decided the election.
How does Winter relate with Waller?
Well, not very well. I mean, they've been cool to each other. They've sort of, Winter has tried to take as much of an independent course as he can take, and he's intellectually, the two are not at all compatible. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, Waller, Waller is certainly, I would say, from an intellectual standpoint, would not stand very high. In other words, what appeals to Waller certainly would not appeal to the average intellectual in the state, for one thing. But I'm talking about mental capacity, though, and being able to understand and assimilate facts and philosophies and so on. I mean, I don't think Waller is he's kind of shallow, there's no question about it. Winter, on the other hand, is a very, very, very bright person and intellectually sound.
Where was he educated?
Well, he's a graduate of Ole Miss, and he's a graduate of law school at Ole Miss. But,
he just had more intellectual depth.
Certainly. He was president of the student body, graduated first, I believe, in his law class, and Waller's, wherever he stood, was way down in his
place. How do you evaluate Winter's chances of succeeding Waller?
Well, as I said, I mean, he is the one figure, the moderate figure that stands out over this whole period, you see, and he will be a candidate, I'm sure, again in 75. And his chances are fair to good, but no better than I mean, I would say he stands somewhere in the 50% bracket as far as his chances are concerned. But actually, it's not a bad place at all to live anymore, I guarantee you. And I went through my trauma, you know, in the 60s. I mean, and God, that's when, you know, that's when a hell of a lot of, like, friends of mine left the state, and a hell of a lot of other people left the state, and they've never come back. But I mean, really, in Mississippi now, just about, I think, at a stage where a person can have a great deal of individual freedom and a hell of a lot of intellectual freedom, and also make a lot of discoveries along the way. And it's still, Mississippi is still in the frontier now, there's no question about it.
How important was the Voting Rights Act?
Tremendously. I mean, it, you know, went from suddenly the black registration went from 30,000 to 300,000, see, within a period of just...
is that really what explains that 71 governor's race?
A lot of it, yeah. That has a lot to do with it.
That politically you could no longer afford to ignore blacks.
Right. But the one thing, though, that it's evident that a black cannot be elected to any statewide office in Mississippi. I mean, I think the old prejudices will work to that extent. But that blacks can be elected to a lot of local offices in Mississippi and can be brought into the decision-making process that way. But if you present a black on a statewide basis, I mean, I just don't see in any time in the foreseeable future that he could be elected.
Well, why? What's the explanation for the fact that there's only one black in the legislature?
Well, that's part. I mean, well, one of the things is the blacks made a. I'm looking for a gas station. Do you see anything down there? The blacks did not choose to put up their strongest people in the legislative race. That was one mistake that they made. And another one that until we get single-member districts, you see, Mississippi does not have the single-member districts. I mean, blacks will have a hard time being elected in the more more metropolitan areas. And that's one of their best places, you know, that they could win office. They didn't run their strongest people for the legislature, but that, along with the fact that, I mean, that single member districts were not established,
next time?
Yeah, they will be
statewide, or just in Hinds County?
Just in maybe possibly four counties. Could be more than that, though. See, there was a lawsuit on it, but it was postponed until after the election, and it chilled it for that time.
How do you characterize Coleman's administration?
Well, by and large, it was a progressive administration. Certainly, he advocated things which I think deal with basic reform that the state has got to have to really do some of the things that it needs to do. I mean, they're still working with this outdated state constitution, and he tried to have a constitutional convention, failed in that, and he
they open at night here?
No, I thought this little station here may be open, but still had prejudices against. He was progressive on some things. I mean, he was certainly against, you know, any mistreatment of blacks, and he took the side of justice. And one of the key things that he did, of course, was invite the FBI in to investigate the Mac Charles Parker lynching, when the Citizens Council, of course, was screaming just the opposite, that, you know, that we're being invaded and everything. And, Coleman, on the score of decency and justice, was right, was on the right side. But as far as really, I mean, black participation in the black civil rights movement, and, I mean, he did not really have a real understanding of it at that time. But he was also one who, Forbes was governor in Arkansas at that time, and the defiance that Forbes attempted over there, Coleman was certainly just the opposite. I mean, he did not believe in defying the federal government at all. And, he was a strong advocate of public education and against abolishing public education as any sort of a device for maintaining segregation. Fellows, we're either going to make it or we're not going to make it. Acceptance of ideas now that were never acceptable before. That it's sort of heartening. I mean, to see what you can present an idea now, and you find a certain number of people will accept it. You see, I mean, formerly we would reject it out of hand. And I don't know that.
One example of that, the appointment of blacks to important positions in the state government, where predictions were that all hell would break loose, and nothing has happened.
Thank you.
3, 4, 5. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Well, I mean, are you talking about when Waller took over, you mean?
We were talking to the press secretary this afternoon. You know, they expected just a deluge of letters and phone calls.
Yeah.
And,
all right, now, example now.
Nothing happened.
One letter. Right. He declared Medgar Evers Day, you see, I mean, in Mississippi. Now, you see that, you couldn't have picked out one thing if you wanted to touch the hearts of the black community and then drive, hackles up and down the necks of the Citizens Council. I mean, that would be the way to do it. See, and Waller comes along and does it.
Why did he do it, or how did it come about, do you know?
Nothing. We had no sign of it. It was just one of these things out of the blue. That's the way he does a lot of things. I mean, he's unpredictable as hell. I mean, when he does something, you have no idea that it's coming.
Symbolically, what was the importance of declaring Medgar Evers Day?
Well, symbolically, he had released from the penitentiary, Parchment Penitentiary, a guy named Charles Clifford Wilson, who was convicted in the Vernon Dahmer case. You know, civil rights, I mean, a black leader in Hattiesburg who had firebombed, was killed in a firebomb by the Klan, you see, in 1966 8. And he, and Wilson was one of those convicted, one of the Klansmen. See, well, Waller had let him out of the penitentiary on a work release program, and had some commitment apparently to do that. So, and when he let him out, well, I mean, this infuriated the black community. You see, well, and he knew that that he had done something that really hurt him. You know, so. Apparently, he was looking for something that would, you know, give some pride and also restore. I mean, and remove some of the hurt from what he had done. So, I mean, and he popped this thing out. Of course, there was a little byplay that took place between him and Charles Evans. I mean, see, Charles, of course, was his opponent for the governor's office. Well, I think for a long time he'd wanted to do something of a little positive nature, you know, with regard to Charles. So that also gave him the opportunity to do that.
What did Medgar Evers Day amount to? I mean, what actually occurred on Medgar Evers Day?
Well, it was there was a program here at 10 years after the, you know, the assassination, and Charles was the principal speaker.
Were the two on the platform together?
No, Waller didn't go. Waller did not go.
Was there any reaction from any whites?
Oh, you mean when he? Yeah, well, sure. They're declaring of the day. Yeah, good gracious. Yeah, there were a lot of
like what
angry kind of letters, you know, and
to the governor.
Well, I mean, newspapers and. But actually, he got away with it. I mean, I think he got away with it pretty well. I mean, you can check with McKellar on what the how the mail ran his office, but I think he got away with it pretty well.
Ask me about, you know, what kind of a governor was Johnson?
Well, overall, Johnson was not a bad governor, except from the standpoint of being an administrator and a leader. I mean, to really provide direction for the state. He really sort of vacated the office most of the time. I mean, he's a sort of a lazy guy who really didn't like the combativeness of politics, and he didn't like the strain of the office, and he would sort of show up infrequently and do something, and sometimes it was good, and often it was bad. The highlights of his administration, though, I would say, would be, first, he did not follow the course of defiance that had been set by his predecessor, Ross Barnett, and having been elected sort of as the logical successor to Barnett, since he had been lieutenant governor under Barnett, and his main campaign fort was, of course, the fact that he had stood up to the federal government at Ole Miss. I mean, he was able to identify.
Am I correct? Much of his campaign literature showed a picture of him with a fist.
James P. McShane, yes, who was then chief of the United States Marshals. On one of the occasions of James Meredith being brought to the campus at Ole Miss, and there was always a joke about that photograph, though, that it's supposed to have been taken in sequence, and the next picture in the sequence is supposedly Johnson shaking hands with McShane, but it looks like he has his hand up in a gesture of defiance, you see, and so that made a beautiful campaign photograph for him, and of course this swept him right into office. He defeated, as you recall, J.P. Coleman, who had, you know, defeated him in the 55 campaign, and Coleman had a good, well, I mean, he
he was highly regarded by most Mississippians as having been an able governor, so on. And so Johnson beat him, and beat him rather handily, purely on this identity with the old Miss Defiance. But anyway, the main thing that Johnson surprised a great many people from his inaugural address on. I mean, he adopted sort of a much more moderate course than anybody ever thought he would. Significantly, between the time he was elected and the time he was inaugurated, President Kennedy was assassinated, and I think this made quite an impact on Johnson. And whether this is really the reason or not, but I mean, but his inaugural address in '64 was a tone of moderation, which really none of us, I mean, observed politics ever expected him to adopt. And he talked about, you know, getting back into the mainstream of American thinking. Well, of course, this was sort of radical talk at that time, and we didn't know how he was going to implement it. Well, he did a few things. Well, of course, and he was presented in 1964 with the COFO movement, and the slaying of the three civil rights workers in Neshoba County, and he did not really acquit himself admirably, I would say, in that episode. I mean, he sort of he was rather defensive on the side of, you know, Mississippi and the nature of the defensiveness that it takes and whenever you're confronted with anything involving the federal government. And at the same time, whereas he didn't publicly do things, privately he did some things, I think, that were rather good. One was that he agreed with the FBI that the evidence that they had gathered in that case before they made the arrest would not be turned over to the state prosecutors, which would be the district attorney in that district, because he felt that it would be just a waste, and the fact that, and he did not have any confidence that the state, which would in effect would be the county, would proceed with any prosecution, and he felt that the federal route was the better. So he would do things like that. I mean, after maybe a series of things that were negative, then he'd come up with something like that. Another highlight, of course, was after the passage of the Civil Rights Act in '64. I mean, he did not advocate defiance of it, and he also later agreed that the State Board of Education should sign the compliance agreement, put the state in compliance with the Civil Rights Act. However, I mean, he would sprinkle these, I mean, things with really some unconscionable statements in between that would sort of, you know, mitigate the positive nature of the things that he would do. Another act of courage that he did, and I mean, on an issue that's really a Mississippi issue, that was prohibition. He was presented with the first bill to legalize liquor and repeal prohibition that had ever been passed since the state became dry in 1908. And he agonized over the bill right up to the very last, and then decided to sign the bill. And I think it was courageous in view of the fact that he had always run as a dry, you know, and he had, and it's one of his most influential backers, at least this group of backers, are the Hederman family, which owns the two Jackson newspapers, and they are very staunch prohibitionists and dryers, and they had strongly advocated that he veto the bill. He really withstood pressure from them to sign the bill. So, I mean, he had, I would say, about three peaks in his career as governor, with a lot of valleys in between. And one of the things was that he would just disappear, you know, for a long time, and sort of let things go, and things were going badly a lot of times, and he would do nothing to, you know, help provide any sense of direction. And the legislature really ran a very independent course from him too. You'd give him, say, in the context of Mississippi, a fair grade, but not a real high grade. He did not make good appointees, though, and this is one of the things that I think his appointments probably lived after him to really hurt his image more than anything else. I mean, he named really unqualified people in a lot of places, and their terms would not expire until some years later. And I think this probably sort of weakened his effectiveness. I mean, the image that he left with the state.
How significant is the R&D Center? He was pretty much responsible for that, right?
Yes, the R&D is a valuable tool in the state, but it has not really probably reached the fulfillment of the goals and the bright prospects that were foreseen when it was created. And its mission has sort of never been really fully accepted or understood by state administrations since then. And it provides good service, but it is not. It is not really given the sort of bootstrap improvement to the state's economy
still going on.
Concept of that Johnson had originally, and some of the supporters of it. Good Lord, it looks like it's raining still.
Oh, it's got a shower.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
The Republican Party, where are they and where are they going?
Well, I guess you would say the Republican Party is the best organized party, the only organized party in the state. It's still essentially a kind of a silk stocking party that's trying to bring in new elements, including a few blacks. And I would say, though, it has its own elitist group that's running it, and there's been evidence of dissension in the ranks that it surfaced in the 72 campaign. And it was pretty well put down, though, and it seems...
Is any rivalry between Clark Reed and Carmichael because of that 72 race?
Well, it doesn't seem to be, even though Carmichael did not get the endorsement, of Nixon. Reed was sort of riding two horses in that particular race. I mean, he was strong for Carmichael on one hand, and he was strong for Nixon on the other hand. I don't think that. I mean, apparently there's no real bitterness there.
Can I swap chairs with you? Punch over here on that.
Carmichael is. Well, he's ambitious, and this is the only route he has to travel. And I think he considers himself more popular than Reed, actually, which is probably true. Reed still pretty well, controls the party machinery.
How organized are the Republicans? I keep hearing they're the only party, but they've got, four legislators?
Yeah, but they've elected a lot of municipal offices and a few county offices. They did pretty well in last year in municipal offices. Surprisingly so. I mean, after Watergate was already broken and going on, they were still able to win a number of Republican offices. There's some little towns in the state that the officials just turned over completely. They were Democrats and became Republicans. And this happened in, a half a dozen or so little towns. And a lot of miscellaneous Republicans were elected all around. Well, I think the main strength that they have is they have this organized giving. And they have a steady flow of money coming in. And consequently, I mean, they're in a position to put money in campaigns, whereas the Democrats don't have that source of money. And of course, they've had the benefit of having the popular type heroes, Agnew, Reagan, etc., that they can haul in here for put on fundraising dinners, you see, and drag in a lot of Democrats or erstwhile Democrats, and get a lot of popular support that way. I mean, the mass exodus of Mississippi Democrats to the Republican Party, though, has never really taken place. I mean, there's never the precise opportunity hasn't really come yet, I mean, it looked like we were sort of on the verge of it several times, but it never did really take place. I mean, indication of that would have been that after the election of Nixon in '68, suddenly there were a few legislators that decided to identify with the Republican Party, and it looked like there was going to be then a movement of people to run as Republicans the next time around. Well, strangely enough, when the next election for legislature came up, very few legislative candidates identified with the Republican Party, and there was some surprises. Some really what you call redneck counties in the state elected Republicans to the legislature. But real fine woman legislator who's Republican got beat for re-election, and probably the fact she was Republican helped the seat and hold the chip, other things that went against her. But I would say having a state headquarters and a constant supply of money and staff people, gives the Republican Party in the state an opportunity to, keep organized. Whereas the Democrats have no headquarters, no staff, and no constant source of money. And of course, the Democrats are split into the two factions of the centers into
do you see that faction, those two factions coming together before 76 or not?
Yeah, I think I said earlier that I think the bridge has been built, I think, from what happened in 72 to make it possible for them to get together. I think they'll have to submerge a few of the personalities involved in order to get it done. And I think it's going to have to be done from somebody out of the Democratic National Committee. I mean, I think a Sprouls or somebody like that is going to have to really, really bring them together and just really knock some heads together in order to do it, because you're still dealing with some pretty strong personalities and people who like the notoriety that they have. I mean, in the position they have, like in the National Party, that they would probably lose if they were merged.
What
Why do you think blacks have fared so poorly in legislative races?
Well, I think they made a mistake. First, they did not concentrate on electing legislators in... they did not concentrate on electing legislators in 71. I think that was a mistake, and they did not put up really good candidates in a lot of places. They had poor candidates, and they didn't support them nearly as well as, I mean, the concentration was on the Evers campaign, and you can see how the vote dropped off, for example, in a lot of counties where the blacks running for the legislature, the vote for Evers would be much higher than the vote for blacks running for the legislature. And, in some cases, it possibly could have elected blacks if the vote had been strong, as strong or stronger. Now, Robert Clark, who is the only black legislator, proved to be a pretty good politician. He produced a vote in his county for himself greater than the vote that was cast for Charles Evers. You see, so this showed that, I mean, he was not a bad politician. The other thing is that in the more urban counties, we did not have single-member districts in the 1971 election, and this is really the best opportunity that blacks would have, I think, for electing legislators. Certainly will have single-member districts in one and possibly as many four counties before the next election.
Somebody asserted to us that Carmichael would have been elected had the president endorsed him and not Eastland back at him, and if the committee to re-elect had given him some money, some resources.
Well, I think probably it would have given him a maybe a little bit better chance, but I don't know. It would have been pretty hard to unseat Eastland. I mean, it would have been pretty darn difficult. I mean, I think you would have had to have... You'd almost have to have the president coming right down here and campaigning for him, you know, and over Eastland. And I don't know how that would have been, how the reaction would have been on that.
The premise was that there's so much anti-Eastland feeling that there would be almost one.
Well, there was a great deal of anti-Eastland. I mean, in the Carmichael got the benefit of the young vote and the new vote, and got the benefit of the black vote, too. I mean, a good bit of the black vote, which normally would not be Republican, but most blacks just can't see themselves voting for Eastland. However, don't discount the fact that Eastland did get some black votes. I mean, he had some organization in some of the black communities. It would have probably been much closer, but I just really doubt whether Mississippi would have thrown out Big Jim. I mean, this is... They like too much the idea that they have somebody who's high in national circles, you know. And I just really doubt that you could unseat it, unseat Eastern. It would have, you know, going back a little bit, like in '64. Now, if Stennis was up for re-election then, it would have been possible to have defeated Stennis in '64 if he had had a strong Republican opponent. He did not have one. See, that was when Goldwater struck the state in '64. The reason was that at the time, the state was still in the throes of the segregation insanity, you see, in '64, and Stennis was the kind of guy who had never really identified with the segregation. Mississippi, at least in that time, and it was really sometime later that Stennis really gained his stature with the average Mississippian, which he now enjoys. But Eastland has always had this identity, you see, with on race, and it'd be pretty hard to dislodge that. Plus, the fact that he had so many local politicians and, out working for him and supporting him. He'd have been hard to beat. I mean, it could have possibly been, you know, real close. But
any indications that Eastland got some of his local politicians that were pretty loyal to his more or less his machine working for Walla?
Yes, you mean in the campaign in 71 and the
right.
Wallace campaign?
Yeah.
Oh, well, the main thing that Eastland did, I think, was to untap the sources of, you know, real good campaign financing. One of the hard things in Mississippi is raising money in a political campaign, and there are just a few good sources for raising money, and Eastland controls most of them, and you turn those loose for
a campaign finance law here. Disclosure law.
There's one. There's one now. There wasn't one then, and it's not a strong law though.
Where does the money come from, or where is it believed to come from?
It comes from big business and from big agriculture, banks. Bankers, individual bankers who are wealthy control a lot of the campaign money. The oil industry, the oil interests, they're pretty stout too. But the money comes out of really individuals. I mean, like, there's no, the corporate cover in Mississippi is not strong enough, you know, we have no ITT and any big sources of, revenue, campaign money, and that usually it comes more from wealthy individuals, but a lot of whom have made their money in agriculture, in industry.
But at Eastland also, though, get the, you know, the supervisors.
County supervisors, right. He has them. He has them pretty well locked up. So much so that in the campaign in '72, when the supervisor had their state convention, they endorsed Eastland and something they'd never endorsed a senatorial candidate before.
But did they have? Were they out working for Waller?